Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. How are you today? I'm good. I'm really good. I love autumn. It's autumn in New York, and we're feeling that chill. Yesterday was especially chilly, and I went to the dentist yesterday. Not a thing that I really enjoy doing. Fortunately, it wasn't serious or problematic, but my dentist is about 4 miles from where I live, and I took the opportunity to walk. And it was such a lovely, fresh walk. Cool. Fortunately, I knew to check the weather, and I dressed properly. But it was so lovely. And I encourage everyone to take the opportunity to walk. Walk. If you think you don't have the time, think about places that aren't that far from where you are. Or you could do a chore, buy something, pick something up, visit someone. It's quite a novel concept, walking. Now, here in New York City, a lot of people walk. We're New Yorkers are very well known for being walkers. But walking is so good for you. And yes, you also can see things differently. When I walk down a street, I see different things than if I ride a bike down that street, if I take a car down that street, or if I'm nearby and I take a train down that street. Every view is quite different. And you can shake up some things that are the same in your life just by making a subtle little change like that. So get out and walk. So I went walking. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, I have a wonderful guest coming on, and we're bringing her on later in the program, Jenny Brown of Woodstock Farm Sanctuary. I'm really excited to have her on. I've had her on a couple of times before, and she's just like dynamite, all energy and all love and compassion, and I can't wait to hear what she has to talk about. But before we get to Jenny Brown, I wanted to bring up a few things. I'm on an email list for Cornell University's, what do they call it, their food and brand lab, and they do lots of interesting things. I just got the results of a study that just came out that they did, and it has to do with what's on your kitchen countertop, and they found that it actually might predict your weight, or the two things seem to correlate. And so just think for a moment, what's on your kitchen countertop, right? Do you know what's on your kitchen? Do you know where your kitchen is? I like to say that a lot. Well, this study looked at photographs of more than 200 kitchens in Syracuse, New York. Now, this is not necessarily comprehensive of all places, but Syracuse is a nice place. And they were testing how the food environment relates to body mass index of adults at home. And what they found out was that women in the study who kept fresh fruit out in the open tended to be normal weight compared with their peers. But as this study says, when snacks like cereals, just cereals like Special K, when snacks like cereals and sodas were readily accessible, people were heavier than their neighbors by an average of more than 20 pounds. Now, is this profound? Not really, but if your soft drinks, if your sodas are accessible and nearby, you're more likely to drink them and get unnecessary calories. And the same thing goes with keeping a box of cereal on the counter. So you could go, I guess what people do is they grab a handful when they walk by, as thinking it's, you know, not a bad snack. Well, it can put an extra 20 pounds or more on you. So when I invite you to find your kitchen and learn how to make healthy foods, it's good to have a bowl of fresh fruit out on the counter. Now, I keep some fruits and some vegetables out on the counter only because I've learned that some fruits and vegetables don't do well when they're refrigerated. So I tend to keep my pears out on the counter because, you know, in the society that we live in, we tend to get fruits that haven't fully ripened, and I like them to ripen and get soft. And then when they're really soft, if I haven't eaten them by the time they're really soft, then I'll put them in the refrigerator because I don't want them to start molding. I keep bananas on the counter because I've listened to that very popular song for decades by Chiquita Banana. And you should never leave bananas in the refrigerator. La, 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 la. Did you know that? Well, you'll have to listen to the whole song. I could sing it for you, but I have too many things to talk about. So no song from Karen right now. I like to keep onions and potatoes, actually root vegetables. I like to keep them, like potatoes and sweet potatoes, in a paper bag in a cool, dry place, not necessarily on the counter. And the fruit is conveniently there. I think it's great for kids and teens if fruit's out on the counter all ready to go for them to grab and eat. And there you have it. So there's an actual study that talks about what's on your counter and how it relates to what you weigh. Now, speaking of soda, yeah, speaking of soda, I was just thinking that not only do I not have soda on the counter, I don't even know if I've ever had soda in this apartment that I've been living in for 16 years. If you don't have it, there's less opportunity to drink it. And there's a lot of conversation about soda going on. Marion Nestle, we've had her on the program a number of times. She's a phenomenal person and has written a number of wonderful books about food politics. In fact, she has a website, foodpolitics.com, with a great blog. And she has a new book that just came out about soda. It's called Soda Politics. And we've been talking about this for years now. Soda politics, taking on big soda, parentheses, and winning, which is exciting. Here in New York, our former Mayor Bloomberg tried to increase the tax on soda, and there was a lot of brouhaha about that. For people that are informed about food, we know that soda is not something that should be drunk at every meal. It's unnecessary calories, and even the sugar-free varieties have their own problems. But for those that live in food deserts, for those that have limited information on food, even in the schools, soda is very accessible and very cheap. So we talk about putting taxes on foods like soda. And, of course, the industry, food industry lobbyists fight that. In fact, Marion Nestle reported today, I think it was in today's blog, about a soda tax in Mexico that unfortunately they were trying to get a larger tax. They had a 10% tax for drinks with 5 grams of added sugar per 100 milliliters or more, and they wanted it to go from 10% tax to 20%, and after the industry lobbyists kind of worked with the government, they actually reduced the tax to 5%, and a lot of people are up in arms about that. And if you want to add your 2 cents or more, you can go to foodpolitics.com. Mary Nissel has added some Twitter posts that you can tweet about and also send letters of support for increasing the tax, not decreasing the tax. Soda. Meanwhile, you at home, you know what to do, right? Drinking water, flavored waters with lime and lemon. Teas are lovely. Fresh fruit juice has a lot of sugar in it. It's probably a better choice than soda, but still kind of sugary. It's better to eat the fruit itself. So there are some thoughts on soda and beverages. Now I want to move on to a really fun topic. Halloween's coming up in 11 days. And I know for vegans, Thanksgiving is probably the most important treasured holiday, but Halloween is probably very close. And I wanted to talk a little bit about it, number one, because we've just finished filming a new food show for Responsible Eating Living on Halloween, and it should be up shortly. I want to talk about some of the dishes that we made. The thing about Halloween and all holiday and all traditions, you need to know that we live in a world where everything's dynamic. Everything changes. Even something that's a tradition, it's not cast in stone. It's not something that's really permanent. All traditions, if you review history, have morphed and morphed and morphed, and they're going to continue to be modified to fit society's needs. And let's think about Halloween for a minute. In my culture, the way I've been brought up, we dress up and include images of scary monsters or ghosts or dead people, zombies, vampires, witches, all these scary, spooky images, and we eat lots of candy. And then in addition, it's been extended where you can dress up like anybody, but there is this scary theme of monsters and the eating of sweet treats. And it didn't start out that way. If you read about the history of Halloween, it didn't start out that way. And I don't want to go into the history of Halloween, but I just want to make the point that it started differently in different countries, and then cultures came together. It came to the United States, and a lot of different events merged actually into the current holiday of Halloween. And I say, let's keep morphing this holiday. Let's keep modifying it and make it even better. Let's veganize it. Okay. That's what I'm getting to. So interesting things. A lot of the foods that people make for Halloween parties, for example, are what? They're like body parts, human body parts, right? Eyeballs and fingers and bloody things. So we're kind of glorifying and making fun of this concept of the scary concept of eating human body parts. And what I find kind of bizarre and interesting is that most people every day, they may not be eating human body parts, but they're eating non-human body parts and not thinking twice about the horror, not thinking twice about how scary it is, the slaughterhouses and the factory farms that these animals live in. Animals that are grown for food are living in this scary Halloween nightmare every day of their lives. So it's kind of an odd twist. And something I think we should be thinking about. I'm thinking about it. Anyway, so let's maybe we should morph this holiday, and rather than celebrate gore and celebrate blood and body parts, which is pretty routine in our society today, and not just animals either. I mean, there's so much terrorism going on with people. Why don't we start to celebrate some of the lovely things? For example, if part of the holiday is about celebrating the dead, we can celebrate some of the people who have come before us that have done wonderful things. I like the idea of maybe dressing up as famous vegetarians in the past, like Pythagoras or Leonardo da Vinci. And even more recently, more currently, our dear friend Rin Barry, who passed a few years ago, and he was a great vegetarian historian. So I don't know if you're thinking about dressing up, but now's a good time to think about it, because there's nothing like waiting till the last minute and not being prepared. And things are so different now. I remember when I was a kid, I think creativity used to be encouraged a lot more. And I used to enjoy making my own costumes. And I still like making my own costumes. It's fun. It's original. And you have, like, I don't know, a different feeling about a costume when you've taken the time and the thought to put it together. Who's got the time to do that now, right? It's so much more convenient to go into a store, and they're everywhere, these Halloween stores, where you can buy any costume you want and be anyone you want in that moment. And the reason why I bring it up is because I really believe that the more you invest in something, and I don't mean monetary, the more you invest in time, in your heart, in your soul, into something, the more you're going to get out of it. So if you just run into a store, get a costume, put it on, wear it for a party, okay, it's fun. But if you take the time to think about what you want to be and think about how you might create a costume, it'll be a lot more fun, I think. Now, we just did a food show, as I mentioned, and we're editing it now. The plan is for it to be up before Halloween, but I wanted to tell you a little bit about it because there are some recipes that we made that you might want to consider for an upcoming Halloween party, or actually any party. I think probably the most popular foods for Halloween at a party are the foods that are popular any time of year. Pizza, right? Kids get together, they like to have pizza, they like to have soda. You know how I feel about soda. Well, we decided for our Halloween food show to have a fondue party. And it was great preparing the foods and then finishing the filming and then eating them. But we've come up with this lovely, luscious cashew cheese fondue recipe that makes a great fondue. And for people that have been looking to eliminate dairy in their lives, and for vegans that haven't had cheese in a long time and are used to some of the store-bought cheeses that, you know, are okay, but most of them aren't very good, even though there are a few today that are actually using a more cheese-like method to create their nut and seed-based cheeses with probiotics and enzymes and giving those cheeses and a nice tang to them that you get in animal milk-based cheeses. We really like our nut and seed-based cheeses, and this cashew cheese fondue recipe that we came up with, which you can get at Responsible Eating and Living right now, is so incredible, and it works really well in a fondue pot, and we had a lot of fun making it and a lot of fun dipping things in it. It was really, really, really good. And then we were talking for a while about a chocolate fondue because it would be good to have savory and sweet. And Halloween is certainly about a lot of sweet treats, right? And my partner Gary and I were talking about what we might use to make a chocolate fondue. And I thought about this chocolate sauce recipe that I made earlier in the year. Perhaps you've tried it. And I thought that it would make a great fondue, and I was so surprised at how excellent it is. It's only three ingredients plus water. How simple is that? Cocoa powder, coconut oil, and some evaporated cane juice, which is vegan sugar. And that's it. And it mixes up so easily, and it makes this fabulous, creamy, rich chocolate fondue. A great party food. I don't know if you hear it, but okay. I was thinking that because the weather is getting colder, because it's autumn, that during my program, I wouldn't hear the Mr. Softy truck. But sure enough, right on cue, this Mr. Softy truck is here and going around the neighborhood. And I'm just wondering how much colder will it have to get for the truck to stop coming and keep things quiet. Anyway, it always makes me laugh to hear that song. Yeah, so we made some wonderful foods, and one of the traditions that we have is I love making almond biscotti, and for Halloween, I like to make them in the shape of fingers. And we did that for the show, and we also made homemade graham crackers. And we got dandy marshmallows. These are vegan marshmallows. We got them in our gift bags when we went to the Veg News Comfort Shindig a month or so ago, and we've been saving them just for Halloween. So pouring the chocolate fondue over the graham crackers with the dandy marshmallows is an unimaginable, phenomenal Halloween treat or treat for any time. It's so good. What I love about these particular graham crackers, I don't know if you've ever gone to the store and looked for graham crackers, but they always have honey in them. It's like next to impossible to find a graham cracker that doesn't have honey in them. Do you know of one? You can please let me know. So a while ago, I made a gluten-free graham cracker recipe, no honey. It's funny because graham was named after the man who was vegetarian and promoting whole grains a while back. I'm looking exactly how many, 100 years ago or more. And the cracker was named after him, even though Sylvester Graham, from 1794 to 1854, he founded the American Vegetarian Society, right? And the graham cracker is kind of named after him because he stressed whole wheat flour. And so my graham crackers don't have wheat in them, so they're not really graham. But they taste a lot like graham because they have molasses in them, and they're really good. So that's another recipe that we made for the for the food show. Now, the last thing I wanted to talk about is makeup. Now, for Halloween, a lot of people need makeup, and there are more and more options for vegan makeup these days, and I'm not promoting any, and I can't really recommend the best makeups because I haven't done a study. I know for myself, I typically go to Aveda because it's easy. And I don't wear a lot of makeup, but for Halloween, I might want to have a little face powder or something if I want to look a little gory, lighten things up, ghostly. But I did want to mention that I recently, when I was in California a few weeks ago, I stopped into a 100% pure company. Have you been to any of these? They actually have some products in Duane Reade, which really blew me away. And most of their products are vegan. And I picked up these lovely little lipsticks called Vitamint Fruit Pigmented Sheer Lip Color. And I can't tell you, I'm really, really enjoying them. I like them because they're not made with any synthetic ingredients. They're colored with fruit. And they really have a nice color. And as the weather gets colder, I find as the skin gets drier and more chapped, it's nice to have something like this to keep things moist and dewy. How does that sound? So if you want to learn more about them, they're at 100, the number, 100%pure.com. And check out the Vitamint Vegan Lipsticks if you're into wearing lipstick. They have some nice colors. I especially like the cherry tomato. It's a bright red, and I don't normally see that kind of color in a clean vegan lipstick. There we go. So what else can we talk about? Oh, one last thing. I mentioned this last week, and I'm going to mention it again. I told you that our documentary, The Lone Vegan Preaching to the Fire, which we put out last year, is now being featured on the Culture Unplugged, Green Unplugged Film Festival. And I invite you to go to cultureunplugged.com. And what I didn't know last week, which is why I'm telling you again, I'm going to be telling you a lot, is the festival actually goes till the end of December, and they'll be adding new films all the time. And then there are some nice prizes for the films that are the most viewed or the people's favorite. There's a number of different categories. So I was thinking, if every one of you who listened to this program today went to culturedunplugged.com and searched on Lone Vegan and saw our Lone Vegan Preaching to the Fire film and rated it, we'd have a good chance of winning a prize. So I hope that you would do that and support us, tell people about it. Wouldn't it be great to have a vegan film that won a very cool festival? And as I mentioned last week, too, they have lots of other great films up there. They're all free, and they're from all over the world. It's just an amazing amount of great creative art and informative documentaries. I wish I had more time to sit and watch all of them. So that's culturedunplugged.com. Got that? Good. All right. I think what I'd like to do now is take a brief little break, and I want to remind you that you can always email me at info@realmeals.org. I love to hear from you. And you can just say hi. You can just say you like the program. You can say maybe you don't like the program. Whatever. Ask me a question. I really like to have the back and forth. So please, info@realmeals.org. And let's take a little break, and then we'll be back and bring on Jenny Brown. Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food, right? Right. How are you doing today? I want to bring on my next guest. I'm talking slowly because I'm just trying to hold in my excitement because I know this is going to be fabulous. It always is whenever I speak with Jenny Brown. She's a longtime animal rights activist and co-founder of Woodstock Farm Sanctuary in High Falls, New York, one of the country's most recognized and respected sanctuaries for farmed animals. She previously worked in film and television until when she went undercover in Texas to film farmed animal abuse. That experience led her to dedicate her life to helping farm animals and raise awareness of their plight. Jenny's story and the work of her sanctuary has been featured in the New York Times, Cosmopolitan, Rolling Stone, New York Magazine, NPR's The Diane Rehm Show, and more. She's the author of The Lucky Ones, My Passionate Fight for Farm Animals. And you could read more about her and the sanctuary at woodstocksanctuary.org. Jenny, welcome back to It's All About Food.
Thank you. What a nice introduction. Thank you so much for having me on again.
You are just a superwoman in my book.
I don't know about all that, but thank you. Thank you.
Well, you've been through so much your entire life, and you've gotten over some incredible obstacles and just kept going towards the light and are doing wonderful things for farmed animals today. It's just amazing what you've done. So there.
Well, thank you. And the issue with farmed animals needs to be the social justice movement of our times. And so I'm just one of many agents of change.
Yeah. So let's talk about some exciting things. You've moved or you've expanded. Let's hear about the farm sanctuary, your Woodstock Farm Sanctuary. What's going on?
Well, we'd kind of outgrown our location in Woodstock, and we had 23 acres, and we basically picked up the entire sanctuary and moved about 30 miles south to High Falls, New York, putting us closer to New York City and New Paltz, and which is very much a college town, and we moved to 150 acres, and what's crazy is we were just looking for a larger property, But we came across a place that was called Epworth Camp and Retreat Center, and it's been owned by the Methodist Church for like 55 years. It's a camp and retreat center, meaning it has lodging, it has a dining hall, it's got a fully equipped commercial kitchen.
Wow.
The beautiful Rondout Creek runs through it. We are, you know, in a progressive town, and it's just, it's a whole lot better. Woodstock seems like it would be progressive, but the fact that the concert actually didn't happen there gives you an idea of some of the restrictions that can be put upon any sort of new initiative or endeavor. And basically ours was a good problem to have in that our popularity was growing as such that we really couldn't accommodate the number of visitors who were coming to visit on the weekend. They shut down our concerts. You know, we had had Sean Lennon and Chrissy Hynde and Moby perform for us in concert on site. Big names. And a couple of neighbors didn't like the noise, even though we kept it on the down low. And so we were just tired of it. But we kept the name Woodstock because we like to think that Woodstock, what it's really supposed to stand for, is a state of mind, and it's not a township. So we kept that name also because we've been in business since 2004, and there's a lot of branding behind that. So so we kept the name, but we're right here in the beautiful Hudson Valley and about 90 minutes from New York City, which is pretty fabulous.
Now, I don't know anybody who likes to move. Just moving from an apartment to another apartment is just a nightmare. So you move from 23 acres to 150 acres with your whole family of cows and pigs and ducks and chickens and I don't know what else you have there. What was that like?
Well, we built an ark and we floated down the Hudson River. It was madness. I mean, who does this? Who relocates a sanctuary? But basically, it was just last September that we closed on the property, and we really got to work in building barns and erecting fencing, and we're still going. But we moved all the animals over, species by species, as their barns were built and their pastures were enclosed. And the new property has already allowed us to help a number of farmed animals in need, which is really what it's all about. You know, our mission is to rescue and shelter and advocate on behalf of farmed animals. So this move is really going to allow us to expand our mission in that way, but also to create more outreach and advocacy events. Things that we have planned are our own sort of vegan summerfest. We want to have lectures here with some of the leaders in the animal rights movement. We plan on having vegan boot camps in terms of learning how to eat and cook, volunteer with the animals, get more engaged with this movement, learn effective tools to be better spokespeople for the animals. We're going to be doing a similar thing for youth. We just hosted the Yay Camp, Youth Empowered Action, run by the incredible Nora Kramer. And these are all kids who have ambitions to change the world, and many of them are animal activists. Everything that will be here is vegan, 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 vegan. And, you know, again, not as a religion, but as, you know, because food is advocacy. And teaching people that vegan food is not a diet of denial. It's one of living our values, and it's one of deliciousness, as we know. So just the various opportunities, camps for adults, bringing us all together, feeling like there's community. You know, we don't want to do things that are specifically just for the choir. We want to bring new people in fun and engaging ways. We're going to have our concerts again. We've got lots of stuff planned, and I get just overwhelmed and intimidated just talking about all those plans. And but we opened our doors finally to the public on September 5th. To give educational tours, but the grand opening was pretty overwhelming. It was Labor Day weekend. It was a beautiful day. We got lots of press about the move and the grand opening, grand reopening event, and we had about 6,000 people come through our doors, which was pretty amazing. Vegan food trucks, activities for kids, live bands, and of course, tours and time to go in with the animals and hear their stories and meet them as individuals who have names and not numbers in an environment where they behave very differently because they know they're loved, they know they're safe, and they are, most of them seek out your affection and attention. And I think it's an incredibly powerful form of activism. We hear about the statistics. We hear about the 10 billion land animals who are slaughtered every year in this country for human consumption, but we rarely ever meet them. And here they're tangible. They're not statistics. They are individuals in their own right. They are self-aware. And again, we really feel like it's a powerful form of activism.
You've used the word vegan a few times, and I appreciate
that.
Yes,
I have.
Do you have any feeling about that word? Some people don't like to use it.
I know, but I think we deny what this shift in consciousness, what this diet, for those of us who do it for ethical reasons, what it's all about. And it shouldn't be a dirty word. And I feel like plant-based is more appropriate for those people who choose to be vegan for health reasons, for dietary reasons, for weight loss reasons, for reasons other than the ethics of using animals for food. And
for anything.
I don't mind the word at all. I mean, I think vegetarian has been so bastardized because people will say I'm vegetarian, but I eat fish and chicken.
Right, the feathered and scaly vegetables.
Yeah, and I think it needs to be a word that we feel comfortable in using more often. When we ask for vegan options at restaurants, we're seeing such a shift in inclusion in vegan items being listed and using the word vegan on the menu. And we need more people to understand what that means. And I think that's currently the only word we can use that means I do not eat any animal products. And I think we need to realize, though, that it's intention, not perfection, as my friend Colleen Patrick Goudreau says. And it's not a hardline discipline. I think we can all do what we can. And any step in the direction of moving away from eating animals, animal products, is a step in the right direction. I think we get a bad rap because of the vegan police a lot and the people who are, you know, the meat eaters of the world feel like we try to infringe on their way of life and dictate what others should eat. And what people truly need to understand is it's not a personal choice. There's a victim involved. There are victims involved. And just like we could murder somebody as a personal choice, there are consequences in our society, but there's no consequences for taking the lives of animals, and that's a shame. These are other beings who share this earth with us. We are the species who's put ourselves at the top and think that our interests matter most. And we work towards a shift in the way society views and treats animals, and I think the word vegan needs to be used more and embraced and said with confidence and pride.
Vegan, vegan, vegan. Right on.
Vegan.
I like it. Vegan. Okay, now where do your animals, where do your non-human animals come from?
Right on. You can't imagine the different situations. Not this past Saturday, the Saturday before last, there was a seizure of around 120 or 160 animals who were living in deplorable conditions at a sort of backyard butcher operation, a place that might even supply meat and dairy products to places that fancy themselves as locally raised meat. You know, they make themselves sound more compassionate than what they really are. Animals filled with parasites, covered with lice, emaciated. Pigs who look like they hadn't left, I mean, just enclosed in these pens. Imagine horse stalls. And, who couldn't see out, who were living in, you know, 6 to 10 inches of their own excrement and filth. Pigs are very clean animals. That disgusts them. Piglets, there was attached to the barn in another room was the makeshift slaughterhouse. And when, the rescuers, when our staff and other sanctuaries went there, it was literally a decapitated cow head sitting in a bin, bags full of innards, hooves, legs, bottom of legs that just lined the wall. It was a house of horrors. That's the situation. Oftentimes these animals come from seizures, where somebody has noticed that the animals are being neglected. They're out in freezing temperatures. They don't have shelter. They're living among the dead. We have some famous slaughterhouse escapees, cows who have escaped from halal slaughterhouses. You know, I'm sure there'd be more that would escape if they were out in one of the massive slaughterhouses, but those places are fortresses where it would be impossible for them to escape. They are picked up on the streets of New York City. A lot of people don't realize there's approximately 100 live kill markets, meaning you can go in there and choose an animal and have them slaughtered, take them in the back room, have them slaughtered. And these animals sometimes escape. Chickens, ducks, guinea fowl, sometimes rabbits, strangely enough. Small goats, we've even had calves. And sheep. So, these are the kind of situations. Every once in a while, you learn of somebody who truly loved their animals and they've died, and it's either us or it's the auction. And so we try to help in any way we can.
Wow. You know, I was just talking earlier about Halloween that's coming up, and, a part of Halloween, how it's so, we think of all these gory things about eating body parts, human body parts, but body parts, and people just don't think that every other day is gory and ghoulish and horrific and frightening, where people are putting non-human animal body parts on their plate that have been through hell.
It's so normalized. It's not only normalized in our society, it's celebrated. We are alienated and chastised because we abstain from eating certain foods, and those certain foods are sentient beings. And it's just the mere idea of that that puts people on the defensive. But the problem is that children and people don't see the process. They don't see the suffering of the animals in factory farms. And even on small farms, they don't watch them being castrated and branded and everything else with without painkillers or anesthesia. They don't watch the calves or the kids, baby goats, being torn from their mother's heartbreaking bellows of protest. They don't look at a pig in the eye, meet a pig, see how incredibly friendly and smart that they are. Not that we should base our compassion on intelligence, but they don't have the opportunity to get to know these animals, much less have to look them in the eye and say, I'm taking your life because I think you're tasty, and slit their throats and to slaughter them and butcher them. You ask kids where meat comes from and they point to the freezer or the cafeteria. We've lost our way, and there's such profound cognitive dissonance, and you know, we put those blinders on tight because we don't want to know. And so those perfectly round patties on our, you know, between two, you know, a bun, doesn't resemble an animal. People sit down and eat it. Doesn't resemble an animal. They don't think about that it was an animal. Chickens, people just think, well, they're chickens. They just think that they're mindless, you know, animated creatures walking around who were intended for that use. We've told ourselves we've always done that, but we also own slaves for most of civilization, so it certainly doesn't make it right. Women were not equal to men. No child labor laws. Certainly wasn't marriage equality. We've come a long way, and hopefully we're shifting towards this, but it's a challenge because it is so invisible in our society, intentionally so. And the problem is that, you know, the dairy and meat industries are so powerful, just like, you know, pharmaceuticals and oil, and they filter money into our politicians' pockets on state and federal levels, and it is a broken and corrupt system. But yeah, people had to slaughter their own animals, and if slaughterhouses had glass walls, as we've heard, you know, there'd be a lot more vegetarians and vegans. Watch a calf being torn away from his or her mother. Mm. Look at the life of a dairy cow. See how even though they could live to be 20 years old, they're slaughtered at 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old, to become hamburger meat. The emotional suffering of these animals, the emotional toil on the chickens who are used commercially for eggs, no animal suffers worse than they do. And people think that eggs are this innocuous thing. Well, they just lay eggs, but they could never lay enough eggs to feed the demand, at least in this country. And it's horrifying what we do. We've turned them into commodities. They live a life of suffering and misery for something that is basically, you know, taste, habit, culture, tradition, and the pleasure of our palates. And we just need to keep moving towards making those connections for people and shifting the way society views and treats farm animals.
Yeah, you've hit it all. I want to just go back for a moment and talk about the dairy cows because from a health perspective, I think that consuming dairy is far worse than consuming meat. But the ethics are so powerful, and some of it, we don't see it, but it's right there in front of us. So artificial insemination of cows.
Yeah,
you can go online and just Google it. And you see the most pornographic, horrific, accepted university publications on how a farmer is supposed to shove this thing inside the cow to artificially inseminate her. And it's such a violation. It's horrible. And I've talked to people who like organic milk, and they think the farmers are, you know, so much kinder to the animals, and maybe to some extent they are, but they still have to do this. They still have to artificially inseminate and rape and separate the baby from the mother.
Absolutely. And first and foremost, people need to know that organic has absolutely nothing to do with animal welfare. Free range, cage free, BS. You know, cage-free, walk inside one of those factory farms and see the de-beaked hens living practically on top of one another, realize that they came from the same hatcheries who kill all the male chicks by suffocation or maceration where they're chopped up alive. And they only get to live for 2 years, 18 months to 2 years when their production declines. They're slaughtered as well. They're de-beaked. They're denied sunshine, pecking at the dirt, spreading their wings, privacy and laying their eggs. Free range can mean the exact same environment. It's so poorly regulated, they could open something the size of a cat door for 10,000 chickens living in an industrial shed into a 10 by 10 yard for 5 minutes and then close it. And because they can say the chickens had access to the outdoors, they can get the label free range, and it's preposterous. And my journey, and something I talk about on our educational tours or when I'm doing public speaking, is that, you know, I had no idea. I was a staunch vegetarian, a soapbox preaching vegetarian with my meat stinks PETA shirts and my fur is dead bumper stickers, and I had no idea that the animals who are used for dairy and for eggs suffer far worse than the animals who are used for meat outright. And that is something that is, people truly don't understand. People think, even the most educated folks come to the sanctuary and you see, and they will say, they never realize that a cow even has to be impregnated in order to produce milk. Like there's this magical animal who just spurts milk from her breasts for human consumption. We don't make those connections, and they're mammals like we are. They carry their babies for 9 months like we do. Every cell in their being says, love this being, and wants to nurture and mother. And calves are torn away from their mothers. If they're lucky, they get to spend 48 hours with them, but that's not customary. It's typically 24 hours. They don't just stand there and allow it to happen. They cry and they mourn their babies being torn away. The calves are terrified, have no idea what's happening to them, still with umbilical cords attached. She kicks at the dirt. She rams her head into gates. She bellows and bellows and bellows for days. And some of them stop eating. Some of them just become sick from depression. Some of them stop producing milk. And we continue to, you know, and weeks afterwards, she'll be forcibly impregnated again on even what the industry calls the rape rack. They're not just shoving their hands up her vagina. They're shoving their hands up her anus as well to position her uterus. It's a total violation. If anybody considers themselves a feminist, they need to realize that this entire system is based on the exploitation of female reproductive systems. And, and, you know, not only does she go through the emotional stress of having calf after calf torn away from her, she ends up with so much calcium leached from her bones that it's typically dairy cows who are the downed animals who can no longer walk, who have broken hips, who are the downed animals who are dragged by chains and bulldozers onto the trucks headed to slaughter, because animals have to make it alive to the slaughterhouse so they can't be used for human consumption. So in the life of an egg-laying chicken, again, the life, it's unimaginable to us that they are, they never meet their mothers. It's interesting that we talk about a mother hen and you're so, you know, motherly, like a hen, like a mother hen. Chickens these days don't have the opportunity to meet their mothers. A fraction of a fraction of a fraction meet their mothers. And that's because nobody wants the male versions of the egg layers. And in this country, we have breeds that are used for meat, and we have breeds that are used for eggs. Same thing with dairy cows and beef cows, two different breeds, the Holsteins and the Jerseys for dairy, the Angus and the Herefords for beef, who are not used for milk. But back to the egg-laying chickens, they're sexed. They're basically hatched in cold metal drawers. They are quickly sexed, all the males, and you should see the workers, how they toss them around, how they spread their wings, their legs, how they poke at their vents to see if there's a male organ. And those guys don't, they die in very unpleasant ways, and that's about 300 million male chicks in this country every year. The females are de-beaked. And then they basically go to live, very quickly afterwards, once they start developing feathers, they go to live in battery cages where they live their entire lives denied of everything that makes life worth living for them, so that we can eat a product of their menstrual cycle. It's pretty disgusting when you think about it.
It is disgusting, and it's very bleak, and I know you can go on all day talking about it because it's horrible. We just have a few minutes left, and I would like to kind of talk about the happy side. Oh, no, it's the world the way it is. So tell me some good stories about the non-human animals that are living at Woodstock Farm Sanctuary, and how do they express to you how grateful they are?
Some animals come in terrified, and part of our job is to socialize them and let them realize that they're in a safe environment. And we've seen amazing transformations, just like Junior. He's a steer who escaped from a slaughterhouse in Paterson, New Jersey, who was terrified of people. It was even dangerous to be in with him. And now he's a love bug. He knows his name. He loves affection. He's especially close with some of our animal caregivers, especially Donnell, who's our shelter manager. And Kaylee, another cow who escaped from a slaughterhouse just outside of Philadelphia, also terrifying to be in with her. They know and they understand now. You know, we have sheep who came from one of the worst neglect cases you can imagine with their babies. They were terrified of people. And now two of them especially, they're all four friendly, but two of them especially, you can't get away from them. They want your attention and your love so much, it's ridiculous. They thrive here. We meet all their needs, not only their health needs, but their emotional needs. We, you know, they eat healthy, nutritious food. They interact with us all the time. They get the supplements or the medicine or the veterinary treatments and care that they need. Comfortable, straw-filled barns. Pastures to roam with others of their kind. We do for these animals everything that we would do for our beloved cats and dogs or humans, friends. Why should they be on a different level? And so they thrive here. They live a joy-filled life, and it's the most rewarding thing ever to let a chicken who's been a battery cage chicken, let her out of a cage, see her touch the grass for the first time and spread her wings and lay her eggs in privacy and dust bathe, and it makes it all worthwhile. And we wish we could give every animal this opportunity. We're barely scratching the surface, but these animals are amazing ambassadors for the millions and billions of others just like them who are living and dying for the sake of our palate and our culture and tradition. So again, we are agents of change in trying to change the way society views and treats these animals, and we invite everybody to come to Woodstock Farm Sanctuary and check us out online at woodstocksanctuary.org. Visit us. We're only open through the end of October. For visiting season, we'll open again in April, but you can come and volunteer any old time and sign up for our newsletter because we have lots of fun, engaging events. Follow us on Facebook. We do a lot of advocacy on Facebook. And come meet the animals, because again, meeting them can change your life. It can open your hearts in ways that perhaps you never imagined. And
thank you, Jenny. Thank you. You're just amazing. You're amazing. Compassion and energy and action all in one. You've done such great work, and I know that you're going to continue to do so, and everybody should visit. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you for sharing your stories. Thank you for having me.
Yes, a pleasure. Take care. We're out of time, everybody. Thanks for joining me. That was Jenny Brown of Woodstock Farm Sanctuary. I'm Karen Hartglass with Responsible Eating and Living. Remember, have a delicious week. Bye-bye.